Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 127 of Dominaria's Judgment, a mostly weekly, mostly constructed Magic podcast. I'm Dom Harvey. I'm here with Ari Lax, and this week, the constructed in question is Standard, which we get to take a deep dive on for the first time in quite a while. There have been points in the past few years where one of us maybe has had to care about Standard for some isolated OP-related reasons, you know, some Pro Tour or Arena thing or what have you. But in terms of the audience at large having a reason to care about Standard, this is really the first time in a long time. So it's good to be back. It's refreshing to actually be on the same page as everyone, again, heading into, you know, a season of qualifiers of some kind. And from what I hear so far, it's been kind of a mixed bag. Lots of variance across the board in terms of early RCQ attendance for Standard and engagement with Standard, and I've seen vendors and store owners saying different things about how quickly Standard singles are or are not flying off their shelves, and how many people are getting in the seats there for Standard. But by and large, it seems like there is at least some kind of momentum here, and enough to make it worth devoting a whole episode to, which is a nice thing to say.
Yeah, I mean, I would say my bottom line as a, largely digital player at this point is it's been really good. I have enjoyed this Standard format. Not like, someone asked today, like, what the best Standard format of all time was. I think it was Doomwake. My response was, a set where Ravnica was being released. This is not on that tier, but, like, it's pretty good.
Yeah, and so that thread made me think some doomsaying thoughts almost about how, and we're going to kick this off with a discussion of just the information economy, if you like, around Standard in the present day compared to various points in the past. And it made me think about how the discussion around Standard is just so heavily informed by who is playing it and on what medium. So one of the most common answers, which does overlap with yours, and I think I would agree with this too, would be Innistrad, Return to Ravnica, Standard, or Gatecrash, slash Dragon's Maze, whatever point in there you want to target. And that, I know that Standard format is very fondly remembered, to the point where I think it's Braden, one of the guys who is always around the SCG events, just has a gauntlet of Standard decks from that format that he carts around with him, and so for pickup games between rounds. So easy to unlock the nostalgia there, and there's a lot to unlock. I do wonder, though, if the vast majority of games of Standard of that format were instead taking place on Arena in a context where, like, you can't actually tell what's good because there are no Standard tournaments to play in, and where switching Standard decks is so incredibly wildcard prohibitive because your entire mana base is like two dozen rares, and that's before you even get to the spells. Like, I don't know what the nature of, like, the general sentiment around the format would be under that timeline, and it does make you wonder how many formats have we had under the Arena era, which, if there was any, like, actual competitive scrutiny on them, may have looked either a lot better or a lot worse, but instead they just exist in this quantum state where no one's perceiving them, so no one has a reason to care about them, and so theoretically they exist, but you can't even work them into a ranking or discussion like that because who's even qualified to have an opinion?
Yeah, I think that we saw, well, so I said any of the Ravnica sets, so technically that include Ravnica Allegiance, right? That was the last Ravnica set from the two set Ravnica block. Mm-hmm. That was technically an Arena format, and I think it did relatively well on that platform. And we saw a decent amount of churn even after the mono blue. Like, if anything, we saw more churn after the Pro Tour on Arena than we did. Like, the Pro Tour was the mono blue story, and the format, like, continued after that and was still pretty good. So I don't want to hang everything on the Arena economy. I don't want to let it get away with, you know, not being a problem. But I think that, I don't know, maybe, actually, I'm talking about this because this is, like, the least of those three formats for exposing the Arena issues. Like, yeah, that format, the mana was sort of expensive, but generally okay, whereas I'm just thinking back to the mana bases in, like, Ravnica 1 and Ravnica 2, where, yeah, it was those, like, 20 rare mana bases, and good luck with wild cards ever if that happens.
Yeah, I think the two big differences with the Ravnica 3, the bigger and better sequel, if you like, is that that time you did actually have a Pro Tour, like a big high level competitive standard event to anchor everything that came afterwards until the next set came out with War of the Spark and like overhauled everything again. But also in that format, you not only had the deck that won the Pro Tour and won a lot of people's hearts in that mono blue deck, which was disrespected for a long time because it was the janky deck you would run into at the lower levels of the arena ladder because it was almost all like commons and uncommons, and it was comparatively cheap to build both online and in paper as well. But that also went for the red decks of that era and also the mono white aggro decks of that era too. So if you were someone who was just dabbling in constructed on arena for whatever reason, then it was pretty easy to get your foot in the door that way. And you actually had like a selection of pretty competitive decks to choose between. Whereas this format, I mean, mono red does exist. And from what I hear, if you are playing like best of one standard on arena, it is essentially all that exists. And that's another wrinkle here too, where a lot of the standard discourse is just so driven by best of one on arena, which is functionally a different format. And I think over the years, I'm actually stunned by how much of a different format it has turned out to be compared to best of three. That if that's where you're looking for any of your like standard takes or standard information, then you're going to get just a completely warped picture of what's going on. So you can play mono red. I think as we get through the decks in this standard later, our conclusion is you probably shouldn't play mono red. But other than that, the Haughty Jin deck does still exist. There's like these white aggro decks floating around too. But in terms of what do you build if you are taking your first step into paper and or paper standard, I'm not sure what the answer really is. And then the follow-up question, which everyone else has to account for, is do those people exist? Because there was a time where standard was the onboarding format for competitive play. So much of that has now shifted to Commander, which is you're driving you away from competitive play. So compared to the time where the standard tournaments would reliably be like bigger and also softer, and you'd have those people who were disproportionately playing these like very accessible decks, I wonder if anything now standard is going to have lower attendance, which is going to be concentrated among the people who are really engaged, don't really have card access issues, despite those just being a much bigger issue these days than ever before. And so the idea of the person who you kind of clock when you see them of, oh yeah, they're probably playing mono red, just you get the sense they're new to standard and you kind of know what that means. I don't know if that person like actually exists in the meat space anymore.
I mean, I was going to say the world you're describing sounds a lot more like the world of Magic Online Challenges than anything else.
Yeah, so let's get into this larger topic of just information cascades in the modern day then. So the concept there, the name of that is taken from one of the seminal Patrick Chapin pieces from 2006. So back in the throes of the first Ravnica block when that was at its prime in Standard, which I remember very fondly. As always, the questions of if anyone was actually playing that these days with what we know now and with the increased exposure on it, would we have cause to remember it so fondly? So maybe it's best that one is stuck in the past. But we'll link the piece there in the show notes. Definitely worth going back and reading. But it struck me, even leaving aside just the way he lays out the argument, is some of the assumptions about just what standard as a format and as a concept looked like back then. It feels almost that there's more sunlight on it then in 2006 than there is these days. And you know, the idea of, oh, well, people copied the inferior black-white deck that did well at the Pro Tour, that kind of makes sense, because if you're going to copy something, well, copy a list that did well at the Pro Tour. Well, now it's I copy a list that Mog did well with in the Standard Challenge. Like, the stakes feel very different. And if you want alternative sources of information, it's not even clear where you would look these days. Like, even back in 2006, you could read the articles that people other than Patrick Chapin were also posting about Standard on SCG. You could go to, I don't know, Brainburst, Londis or whatever. You could go deep in the MTG Salvation, forum threads. Now it's just like, you hope that you encounter the right Fire Shoes retweet at the right time, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I would compare it more to, like, if you want to use 2006 metrics, the only thing you have is the Mike Flores gray and blue box whatever like PTQ report article where he's compiled all the PTQ lists, and that's effectively what the MTG Goldfish page is, and that's like 100% of your standard resource these days. He did that. I mean, I guess there weren't really standard PTQs back in those days, but that's a different story.
Yeah, I mean, the idea of a PTQ inherently carried a little bit more cachet than your local RCQ, which, depending on where you are and the time of year and so on and so forth, that could be like a legitimately competitive gauntlet that you had to slog your way through to get the title, or it could be one of the socialized invite, you know, 16 people show up and 8 of them have a real standard deck and 4 of those people know how to play their real standard deck, and, you know, in the land of the blind, the one-eyed man gets the RCQ invite. You really don't know until you like dig deeper into that data. So in that sense, I guess there are more RCQs and therefore there are more data points, but each of those individually is less inherently reliable and counts for less. So it's tough to know exactly what to do with that. The other thing is that you would at least have periodic high-level standard events to use as a bellwether for where the format was going. So you think back to Brad and then Corey just kind of like continually re-breaking the same standard formats over and over between successive standard GPs and like staying one step ahead of themselves and just cashing in that way. And then just seeing how even a few weeks after the Pro Tour, a standard format could look very different because now that people had the information from that and the decklist from that, you could use that as a launching pad to go further and further. And without that initial treasure trove of useful experience and decklist, it's kind of like you don't have that useful origin point. So everyone is kind of random walking across the terrain, and hopefully they collide with each other and have some useful conversations along the way. But in terms of a shared starting point, I guess if no one knows anything, then we're all working from the same list that Mogged played in last week's challenge, but like that's a very different experience, I think.
Yeah, I think the fact that if we were both joking about this, we would say the exact same name, and it's not like, I don't know, back in the day, you know, I'm thinking about like that blue box era, there would be like 4 to 5 people whose PTQ list you would pay attention to over the season, guaranteed. There's not just like one Mogged and they're playing. It's like you're only looking at the Cleveland PTQ over and over and over again.
Yeah, and the PTQ scene as well, I think, rewarded the people who were already in the know to some degree. Like, if you knew which names to pay attention to, like the local ringers who maybe were not well known outside of their area, as you were scrolling through those lists, you could you have an edge automatically in terms of knowing which of those to trust or to start with. Whereas now we're all in like the same cloud economy, I guess, where if you know who Mogged is, great. If you know some of the other grinders, then sure. But otherwise, it's, you know, if someone becomes established as I'm the authority on domain, for example, and one example of that might be Sean Goddard, a beekeeper, who basically was kicking himself and the rest of our team for not playing domain at Worlds. I think we all wish we had done that. And then immediately corrected his mistake by winning the standard showcase and has continuously put up good results with the deck since then. So he has written just this free introduction and guide to domain as he understands it, which we'll link that in the show notes too. That's a useful resource to sink your teeth into. But that's the kind of thing which like that is kind of the only game in town. And so from the content creator viewpoint, there is something useful to establishing yourself as the go-to person for X, even though you can't quite do that in the same way that, for example, you know, Ginger is the Rakdos midrange guy in Pioneer, and he can do that because, well, he now has, what, 4 RC top 8s and however many challenge wins and so on with Black Red, and there's just a long enough time frame that you can put up those results consistently enough that the scoreboard kind of speaks for itself. You really can't do that with this standard format. So yeah, you can top 8 this challenge with a deck, and then tweet that your list is broken and send me 10 ticks on Modo for a cyborg guide. But in terms of consistency over time, like there just isn't enough time or enough tournaments for that to really manifest itself. So I guess the people who already are ahead of the curve or starting from ahead in terms of marketing and stuff, like they just have the same edge that they've always had. But I wonder how the other people, like the unsung Moto Grinders or whatever, make themselves heard in that context.
Yeah, I think that some amount of it is just you, I guess, as the person consuming the content, have to be like rather discerning with like understanding the deck list and the idea of what a good deck list is on your own, and just like actually looking at them and not just looking at the tweets, which again, fortunately, I guess a lot of them are condensed, or at least the ones that exist are condensed. You mentioned all these like 14 player RCQs that have disappeared into the ether because they take registration only on MTG Melee and don't take deck lists except for in paper, but you know, that's how it goes.
Sure. I mean, the whole effect of MTG Melee on tournament reporting is a whole thorny topic in and of itself for another time, maybe. But the other, a few other kind of scattered observations that stood out to me were that there have been times over the past few years where we've kind of had these sudden fluctuations in how much standard was being played or how much info there was, but then that hasn't tracked with how much people outside of that ecosystem have had any reason to care about that. So I know one topic that you've mentioned a lot in the past were the SCG Tour online, not just main events, but also satellites, where you could see this rapid, repeated iteration with a lot of the same engaged players over the course of just a round of satellites. So, you know, Will Pulliam goes 6-0 in the morning satellite with Gruul Adventures, and suddenly Gruul Adventures is the most popular deck in the next satellite. And if in those 4 hours in between, you know what that means and what the next step should be, well, you actually can really get ahead. And now you are the person who you 6-0 the next one, and then you become the reference point, and you get to see that kind of experimentation over time. But if you weren't playing those events yourself, well, you don't really need to care about those sudden shifts. You can just wait until you have the whole week's worth of changes, including the main event. And it's not clear who is even paying attention to that, because unless you are playing in those events yourself, like, where else are you going to play standard, right? So we have stuff like that. And then on a much bigger scale, when the MPL was, you know, giving one last heave, the monthly split system for the MPL and the Rivals, that ended up with more high-level standard than ever, both in terms of regularity and also just how many people and how many matches were being played than ever. But if you weren't one of the 30-something people in the MPL or then also in the Rivals, like, again, why would you care? Where are you playing standard? It's not like you have a standard PTQ to go and hopefully get an edge in using this information that you've gained. There's just, unless you have a academic interest in this format, or you just enjoy watching competitive Magic for the sake of it, you know, a noble purpose to be sure, but in terms of what do you learn about standard, I mean, there's really no actionable information there.
Yeah, I mean, there was also that weird period of time where, like, you had to turn in your deck list for the MPL split 2 weeks early. So I seem to recall there was one where, like, they were playing 2 week outdated lists and, like, someone had discovered something way better in the week in between and played it at, I think this was, like, in the brief period where they were playing these online and there were still paper events, and, like, just people were playing, like, standard at some paper event in the week in the middle. And so, like, the list that you would be playing the following weekend had nothing to do with whatever people submitted in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah, it was also weird looking back at that era where the people playing in the events almost had a more glum view of how stale that standard format was than they had any right to based on the decks that those people themselves had submitted in the format. You know, like, you had people in the MPL saying, oh, I guess it's just another tournament full of Bonecrusher Giant and Lovestruck Beast, or time to play Dimir Rogues again. And it's like, well, yeah, maybe, but also you have these two other decks that have popped up, and oh, here's Mutate out of nowhere, and then 4 months later, here's Mutate again, just like re-breaking the format from a whole different group of people. And there was a lot of churn going on, but there was so much disillusionment with the wider system that the format was being played in, that it kind of like spilled over into the perception of the format itself, and it was like, well, just a plague on all your houses, you know. There's no level of charity here.
Yeah, weird time. I'm really looking forward to this standard to hopefully buck that kind of trend.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about this standard then, shall we? So I guess, first off, big picture impressions of the format from each of our standpoints. So I've been playing a decent amount of this standard so far, only in the leagues on Modo. So all the usual caveats that come along with that. I was able to watch a lot of standard at the NRG championship playoffs this past weekend, one of the three formats featured there. And I have liked a lot of what I've seen, and I feel like I have a clearer sense of what I want to be doing and why. But again, until there's some actual proving ground for this, take all of it with however many grains of salt you feel is appropriate.
Yeah, I'm in a very similar boat where I guess I do want to sort of get this out of the way, and we can talk about this in the big picture of, like, this feels like a standard format where you have very two very clear bounds on either end of, like, you have domain and you have the aggressive stuff, and then a lot of bouncing around in the middle that is very hard to kind of sort through. And they're just, every single one of those is kind of a black, or I guess there's a couple non-black mid-range decks, but they're all, like, largely black mid-range decks. And my problem with that right now is that the premier event that I am looking at for this format is the Chicago 75K, not actually a GP, but definitely a GP. And there's a whole nother set after that. So it's like, there's a little bit of value in sort of discerning the micro of, like, which of that mid-range pile matters and, like, which spot. But I feel like there's a lot more value in, like, vaguely understanding a lot of the format and a lot of the cards, more so than that, and then letting the next set dictate a lot of where those middle decks kind of shake out based on what is added to the format, because presumably you just get another set of good cards to add to your good card pile.
Yeah, it is weird having this conversation, knowing that there will be an entirely new set before a lot of people have the big reason to care about this. And also that tournament in itself is going to be weirdly competitive and limited at the same time, like small L limited, in the sense that the people qualified for the Pro Tour are going to be playing in the Pro Tour, but the people who are not, you're going to see a lot of, like, the 2017 through 2018 Pro Club's finest, you know, kind of showing up, coming out of retirement for another hurrah. And so I think you'll see a lot of, like, really good grinds in there, but the people who, for whatever reason, have just been, like, shunted out of the current official OP system, along with all of the people who they're going to be trying to get their come what may, because it is, like, the largest open competitive constructed event of its kind really anywhere in a long time. And so it's going to be this weird mix of a lot of people coming out of the woodwork that you're going to be happy to see again and happy to watch play Magic, but also there'll be a lot of people who really want to be in that tournament and who are in the building but have, you know, other things to be focusing on in the meantime.
You want to know the exact name of the person who I am waiting to see top eight this tournament, the 75K? Joe Bernal.
Okay.
Basically, you know, last I checked, basically his backyard, the exact kind of person when it's like, yeah, it's just a cash tournament that is vaguely associated with something, is just like, yep, they're in the top eight, doing great. You talk about, like, the Pro Club's finest, like, the epitome of the player who I recall him being like, yeah, I'm just going to sit out of the Pro Tour stuff because I don't want to fly to these GPs when I can just ringer all these local cash tournaments. So we'll see if he shows up or not. But, like, him, I know Matt Hoey was in the NRG championship this last weekend, and he's, like, the other person whose name I would expect. So, like, that is the caliber of player that I am like, okay, these are probably, you know, if you are sitting down to play the 75K, there's going to be a handful of people who are like, yep, this is like a gold or platinum level pro from back in the day. But, like, those are the ringers I'm watching out for.
Yeah, people like current interim Jerry T podcast with Dave Shields co-host Matt Costa, not Dave Shields. People like that who I think, given the chance to, like, set aside a weekend to play in something big, this is big enough and engaging enough that it will, you know, summon them to wintry Chicago in the dead of winter. So I'm excited to check in on that event when I can. Hopefully I will be too busy to do that very often, but we will see. In any case, for now, we have an entire RCQ season to work our way through, and hopefully some amount of that info will still be relevant heading into you know, the next phase of Standard once we get the MKM cards. So I think Domain is a good place to start. And if you want to start with Domain, again, that primer by Sean Goddard, I think, is very useful. But there's been a lot of grumbling or debate around Domain's role in the format. Like, is this a good thing to exist? A lot of people are just kind of put off already by the idea of Domain being so dominant, and then the idea of playing Domain mirrors, which you know, the round clock issue there is kind of catastrophic. I think you're on the same page here. I almost like that Domain provides this anchor for the format of sorts, where if you get into the morass, which we will soon, of all of the different black mid-range decks and how they line up against each other, and there are so many good cards in each color at each spot on the curve that you could play, that it's kind of hard to know how you're meant to fit those all together. It's nice to have this defined test that you have to pass at one extreme of the format that that makes some of those choices stark for you, where like you think about the three or four different varieties of black red mid-range, from like the small aggressive version all the way up to I am reach the multiversing into Atali or vice versa. Like, those are so different that they're effectively not the same deck, but the idea of how they line up to, against Domain is a really nice way of framing that conversation, where are you trying to go underneath Domain? Are you trying to go over the top of Domain, if that's even really possible? Or are you trying to just, like, I don't know, meet them in the middle and hope that they stumble and your, like, weirdly in-between mid-range formula gets the job done? Like, that, I feel like explaining their respective Domain matchups is the perfect introduction to what they're trying to do philosophically.
Yeah, and I have a few other things that I really like about the deck. Like, it is a Domain deck, which is a named mechanic from a set, like a primary named mechanic from a set in the format, which is rare these days that you have a deck like that. Like, there's multiple Domain cards in the deck. It's very clearly about having five colors. Like, I don't know, like, I don't even know if the Invasion Block Domain decks had this many Domain cards. And like, the deck doesn't really take game actions until like turn 3.5, which is very, like, if you want to beat that, there's like very defined ways to do that. And like, it is, I mean, technically they can play Leyline Binding on two with their best draws. And like, you've just described a point where their nut draw is a terminate. So whatever. It has some of the like, Leyline Binding is exploitable aspects with a couple cards that I think we'll get to later. Just like, I think that's really good for the format. And outside of the mirrors, where both players, I guess there are some games where one player has like two up the beanstalks and the other has zero and no cards and the game is over. But like, aside from the mirror games where both players have an up the beanstalk and it's like life totals are effectively a million, the fact that it simultaneously like gains life and runs the game out once it starts taking control is like almost sort of nice, because like, you know, it's over. And like, in a, it's not in a I think the deck, I would say it's not like a Tooth and Nail thing where it's like they paid 9 mana and then I died. It's like, oh, they took their big game actions and their 7 drops won the game like a 7 drop should. I don't know, I really like the deck's presence in the metagame.
Yeah, I think that I get the complaints that this is more of just go big Battlecruiser Magic, where you never run out of cards, and like the deck is, it's not quite doing the same thing every game, but it feels like it doesn't have the inherent inconsistencies that dedicated ramp decks in the past have done, where you think about the classic ramp formula of you have a bunch of ramp spells down here and a bunch of really expensive big idiots up here, and you need to draw them in about the right ratio and have it all come together in the right sequence. This deck is really not that. Like, you're not all that rampy, honestly. It's just Topiary Stomper and Invasion, and if you have the two together, then you have this nice little this nut draw in place. Individually, you know, there will be games where your only way of ramping is you play a Stomper on three, you play like a Sunfall on five, Archangel Nexon, and you kind of slowly work your way out from there. Or your Invasion by itself, 4 up to 6 or up to 7 is a very like relevant threshold that gets you to in the space of one card. And then beyond that, the cards you're ramping towards, other than Atraxa, which is such a big prize that it's kind of worth accepting these trade-offs for, your other payoffs are flexible or scaling. So Herd Migration, that's a great card to cast with 7 mana when you have breathing room to kind of take over the board. But also, if you just need something to do to set yourself up early, you cycle that thing on two and it ties a room together. Likewise, Archangel of Wrath, I think this is like the unsung hero of the deck, which is the reason that it works more so than anything else, which is that it kind of tracks your ramp spells as you go up the curve. So let's say you've got your Disdainful Stroke or your Mages Appear Ready against your domain opponent, right? So turn four, they play their Invasion of Zendikar. Well, if you counter it, then next turn they still get to like just play an Archangel with Kicker or something. They're still using their finisher in a relevant way. But then if the invasion resolves, then they have all the mana they need to attempt however many big things they have in their hand. And also, like, the Archangel then is souped up because you can double kick it, or you can double kick it targeting and then flipping the invasion, which is a nice angle as well. Yeah, the games where you draw like three attractors or something and you can't do anything with them, those don't quite exist in the same way, because other than literal attractor, all of your attractors are like cycling, you know, find a land, gain three life, or their Archangel, which is a four drop through a six drop. Like, you have ways to use your mana, but those also are ways of using like smaller units of mana too. So that kind of inherent inconsistency is just kind of ironed out there.
Yeah, I think this speaks to something that Sean has highlighted in his sideboard guide, but I was like almost even more aggressive about, which is that one of the things you will find when playing this deck is that the first cards you cut are just like your ramp spells and your beanstalks. Just because like the difference between casting Sunfall and Atraxa on turn five is like pretty marginal, and the difference between like Sunfall on four and five, like, is basically made up by instead having a spell that you can cast on turn two or three that impacts the battlefield. So like whenever you're siding in a bunch of knockout blows, that speaks pretty strongly to like, you talk about these games where it's like, oh, well, you know, they cast their invasion, but then like they would just cast a Sunfall if you countered it. It's like, yeah, well, what if you just put things on the battlefield? Your goal is to kill them because they paid four mana for a card that does not impact the battlefield. So that's often the axis that you are trying to minimize moving into games two and three.
Mm-hmm. We also have Sunfall as the main sweeper of the deck, which in its own way is a big limiting factor and a litmus test on the format. I know that we've had another round of casual EDH, which I guess is also CEDH, Twitter discourse today about Farewell and whether that card should exist, and that's now spilled over into should Sunfall exist. Sunfall is, I think, the best sweeper of its kind that we've had in a long, long time. And it kind of has to be, because conventional Wrath of God effects, like if literal Wrath of God existed, I don't know how playable it would be. Sunfall has enough extra stuff between exiling everything and the incubate token giving you this finisher or blocker after the fact, and also costing five instead of four means that it now also triggers up the beanstalk as well. Like, Sunfall is the thing that, if you're trying to race domain on the board, is always like this looming threat that you warp the whole game around. And again, like you have this nice curve of Stomper into Sunfall, and you don't really care that you're like sweeping away your own game piece because you have this bigger game piece left over after the fact. Sunfall is the sweeper that like makes this deck work effectively. And I know that in some of our world testing, we started with a heavier black focus list of domain with some of the cheap black removal and Drag to the Bottom, which is also an excellent sweeper but doesn't have all the extra bells and whistles that Sunfall does. And ultimately the white versions have largely run out, even though like if you're under pressure there's a big difference between four and five and so on. I think just Sunfall, even in the mirrors, it's like weirdly important, where if you're getting to the stage where you have Herd Migrations being slung back and forth, and you've got to clean up an Atraxa and an Archangel of Wrath or something, it turns out that Sunfall is actually a weirdly relevant card in these spots that you wouldn't expect it to be. And so, yeah, I mean, Sunfall, you could reconstitute the deck without Sunfall, but as it stands right now, it is the reason, or one big reason, to build the deck this way.
Yeah, I am weirdly torn on whether I think this card is like disgusting and overpowered and like totally fair. Like, on the surface, you're kind of just paying seven mana for like, I don't know, Desolation Giant existed in 2001. This card is not egregiously far off of that. But at the same time, I think there are things that the exile is like relatively oppressive to, and it's one of the pieces of the deck that I almost wish you could be more exploitative of across the card pool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and going back to what you said about the ramp spells, I at the same time am a little surprised to see so many lists cutting the fourth invasion of Zendikar, and I would prefer to have that in my main deck if possible, while at the same time, I'm very willing to just get all copies of that card out of my deck in some of these post-war games where the idea of taking turn four off to jump up to seven mana, you just don't need to do that because you have relevant spots, all the relevant cards at every spot on the curve, and you can just cast those instead of needing that exact sequence. And when you're doing that, you can also cut stuff like Atraxa, which is just a seven drop too. So the deck is pretty flexible in that regard. I think one of the main issues with the white heavy build at the moment is you kind of don't take those relevant actions until early on unless you have exactly leyline binding, and often binding is heavily taxed. They have a lot of threats that you need to deal with. You need the right land sometimes to actually get the relevant discount on binding in a timely way. And so one way to bob and weave around domain is to just flood the board early in a way that is somewhat like Sunfall resistant, and then force them to have at least the first binding. And then even if they do, sometimes that's not enough. So like the banned Toxic deck, which got first and second in the finals of one of the standard challenges last week, that is almost tailor-made to beat up on a deck like Domain, where you can goldfish them very quickly. You have enough permission and so on that if their first relevant play is a Sunfall, you just swap that out of the way and move on with your life. And then also you get the kind of a combo end game with like March of Swirling Mists and Rot Priest sometimes. And so you can almost fight them on the early game, the mid game, and the late game all at once. And so that's, you know, that's the perfect spot for a deck to be. Alternatively, if you look at the Domain sideboards right now, like you see these four knockout blows, which you need to beat a deck like Mono Red, and they're good against Mono Red. And often those games come down to, did you draw one or more copies of Knockout Blow? If you can be an aggro deck that just is not vulnerable to that card, then it's kind of weirdly hard for them to do anything until like the first Archangel or Sunfall. And if you can find a way to not care about that, then you're good to go.
Yeah, I also want to point out, you mentioned how Infect plays in a way that's resilient to Sunfall. I want to point out their copies of Bring the Ending and the fact that they are uniquely, so because of the way Toxic works against like the Archangel of Wrath life does not matter. The deck goes wide in ways that a light Archangel ping is not going to matter, and Atraxa is largely not going to matter. Sunfall is like almost unique in what it does in the deck, and I guess Herd Migration as well, but those are the two spells, like it has condensed its opponent's threat base that matters into the cards that are not protected by Cavern of Souls.
Yeah, Cavern is, I don't know if you could see coming that like Cavern on Angel in the five color ramp deck was going to have such a warping impact on the format, as opposed to, I don't know, like Cavern on Merfolk or Cavern on Humans in a more conventional tribal deck, but that's the world we live in now. As it happens though, Cavern makes it much less reliable to do the standard thing of, I'll just disable stroke your Atraxa or something. Like you really can't rely on that. So if you're planning to fight them with soft permission, you almost have to take the first opportunity that's presented to you. So yeah, you fire it off on the Topiary Stomper that you don't actually care that much about, because once they get up to the Archangel or whatever, like there's no guarantee you can contest that instead. Or you try and move the game to a spot where the thing you care about can't be caverned through. So it's, you know, you blank that Archangel, you only care about the Sunfall, and then you counter the Sunfall instead. Other ways of kind of fighting Domain on the stack in that way, I know Tishana's Tidebinder has got a lot of press, in part because of Cavern, right, where that is still a way to blunt the impact of a Cavern creature. There's some weird interactions going on there. So you know straight up that, okay, you Tidebinder Atraxa, they still have their 7/7, but hopefully by that point, one big blocker is not enough, especially once you take the lifelink away. The lineup against Archangel is worth examining quickly, because what Archangel does is, if it's kicked twice, it puts two separate abilities onto the stack. And so you could tie by to one of those, and you'll get the lifelink and the flying away no matter what. So the other trigger that sticks around will not have the lifelink attached to it. Which in turn means from the Domain side, sometimes what you'll do is you will, let's say your opponent has a deep cabin bat and something else, you might double up your triggers targeting the deep cabin bat on the grounds that, well, yeah, if they have the tie binder, I get to kill this anyway, even without the lifelink. There is a trade-off there, because if they don't have the tie binder, you've wasted a damage trigger and the two life that comes with it. But if all you care about is killing the bat, then that might be the best way to hedge. But be aware of how that lines up. I think tie binder is actually a little oversold, both against domain and in general, because as we'll get onto with a geological appraiser, among others, a 3-2 body is like weirdly embarrassing in this format at the moment, and even against domain. So specifically, if you are going to tie binder their topiary stomper, do not then attack into the 4-4 stomper that can now attack or block regardless of their land count, thanks to your tie binder. You can tie binder their invasion, like that actually is a very good lineup, but even against Archangel, for example, you get one half of their triggers, and now they have a 3-4, which is very conveniently sized to keep your 3-2 tie binder body at bay. So it often is a very expensive stifle, and that's not really the goal that you have in mind for it.
Okay, I got two things here. One, you mentioned tie binding a battle. I would like to ask you what happens if you tie bind the other trigger on a battle. This is a pop quiz. If you don't know the answer, that's okay.
Can I phone a friend? Can I call for a judge?
Okay, so I'm gonna reference rule 310.7. If a battle's defense is zero and it isn't the source of an ability which has triggered but not left the stack, it is put into its owner's graveyard. So you can Tidebinder the back half of them flipping an invasion. Just wanted to throw that out there, and that I believe that ends very well for you.
Yeah. There's weird stuff around that with like sagas as well. So I learned yesterday that if, let's say you play an Urza Saga, the first chapter trigger goes on the stack. If your opponent calls for a Magus of the Moon in response, you have a window to kill the Magus while the trigger is still on the stack, and the thing that would normally kill the saga by save base effects has not kicked into effect yet. And so while the chapter trigger is there, you have this weird window to like deal with that problem, and then the saga sticks around because the chapter is still there. It's very, very strange. But yeah, there's like weird stuff like that lurking everywhere.
Okay. And then not cursed knowledge. I think we'll get to this when we start talking about the decks that actually have Tidebinder in them. I honestly have had an experience where Tidebinder is more impactful against not domain than it is in these spots where you're talking about where they still have the 7-7 angel or whatever. Where like here it's very clear you are getting half a spell because you're hoping the half of the spell that you cover is the more powerful half and you can kind of mop up the rest. It feels like there's a lot more spots against the rest of the format with like normal cards where you actually get almost a full card off of Tidebinder. So I think that the gap may actually be in the effectiveness of some of the Tidebinder decks and draws in utilizing the parity that Tidebinder maintains more so than the actual card Tidebinder being bad.
Yeah, I think the play patterns in practice is one of those classic cards, and this is true of basically everything in standard most of the time, and including this standard, but you feel it very acutely with Tidebinder, where it's brutal when you're ahead and you catch something relevant with it, but it feels so clunky and situational when you're behind and they have maybe some room to like bob and weave around it. So even against some of the other like black midrange decks, for example, a lot of the creatures that you would want to Tidebinder, just the bodies line up very well against the Tidebinder afterwards. So like Preacher, Shieldred, Rafine, all of those, like just having a random 3-2 doesn't really get you anywhere. And then even stuff like, you know, I hear Tidebinder touted as it's really good against Subterranean Tuna. And like, yeah, it is if the opponent lets you catch them with it, which like if you, with some of these decks, if you are passing the turn with three mana, there's not that much else that it could represent. And there's some overlap in how you would play against Tidebinder there and how you would play against like whatever the removal spell is that it could be instead. And so if you are wasting that amount of mana every turn and the opponent can just not give you a good spot to leverage your card, like that is how you lose games of standard a lot of the time, is having a mediocre card which in turn is tying up your own mana. And for all that Tidebinder can do when it's firing all cylinders, you have to be careful to not chase the dream with it when the opponent can kind of take that dream off the table for you.
Yeah, I think that that is a good summary of it for now. I think we'll talk more about it, like I said, when we get to Dimir. Back to Domain, which of, like, you know, there's probably, like, what, 54 cards in the main deck that are pretty locked in. What have you kind of enjoyed in those last few slots?
Yeah, this is the weird thing about Domain, which is even though you are a literal five-color deck with access to any color of mana on demand, there's some qualification to that where you can't be too heavily invested in any one color or multiple colors at the same time, where, like, you're kind of a green-white deck splashing a bunch of other stuff, and so if you decide you want to have some double black card or whatever, there is actually a real cost to that some amount of the time, so you've got to be wary of that. But even though, in theory, you can commit to whatever colors you want, you don't have that many spare slots to do that with, and it's not clear which of those like options in various colors would even help the issues, because if you look at the fundamental problem of my deck just doesn't really do enough stuff early, well, cheap cards in a splash color don't help that as much, because if you can't cast them as early as you need to cast them, then what are they actually doing for you? So once you take that into account, there's not actually that many good ways to fix the curve issue that the deck has down low. And so you could main deck some destroy evils or something, which they can be good against the black midrange decks, and also are quite nice in the mirrors as well. Or, you know, there's stuff like that you can do, like more sweepers into populate or wandering emperor. You could main deck some sea sharks. I think that's totally fine. But none of those really fix the hole which I would want to fill if I was going to really commit to the deck for a full season.
Yeah, I know the card that I am extremely against is Carnosaur. I played mostly with that card when I was playing with this deck, and Trumpeting Carnosaur is just, like, not a good Magic card. Outside of the, like, Eldritch Evolution abuse cases where you just are exploiting the fact that it's an ETB that you have created some stupid loop with, it's just Enlisted Worm, which was not a good card the first time, and that format was weak. And people got mad at me when I said this, but I think that most of them were trying to, like, kiki-jiki their Carnosaur. So that's all that entire first case, which is just, like, yes, this is a loop in some circumstances. When you're just casting the card with the intent of, like, discovering five and having a 7/6, that I don't think that's a good Magic card. And, like, people reference the Open Fire, but that's also not a good Magic card. Like, I actually think that my experience playing with and against Carnosaur is that the majority of the time that you use the discarded to deal three mode, you are, like, better off just, like, looking at your hand and asking yourself if you could do anything else to just cast this as a normal Magic card instead of committing yourself to this grossly underrate mediocre optional play. I think that, like, my opponent has been at three life before. That's the only time I've been like, yes, I've got this.
And then felt disappointed because you can't actually target them.
Yeah, exactly. You know what? It's that did happen.
It's like, so as is often the case with Cascade S mechanics, the card is at its best when you remove the variance, which is meant to be the point of the Cascade mechanic. And so I think in a deck like this, where it's either a very inefficient removal spell, or it's because it's so expensive, it feels like by the time you're casting it, you're just kind of trying to high roll, where if you hit the sometimes your best hit with it is, like, Sunfall. Weirdly, you hope that it's just some, like, Descend Upon the Sinful style thing. But often it's like you hit one or two specific cards and you win the game on the spot, and you hit anything else and it's like, well, that was not the game-winning investment I'd hoped for my six mana. So I like it in very specific builds of the black-red decks where you have enough stuff going on early that by the time you're casting it or reanimating it or whatever, it's like, well, basically anything in the broad range of playable cards in my deck is going to move me across the line. But in a deck like this, where it's another expensive card in a sea of expensive cards, it is really not addressing the issues there. And, like, going back to the point about information cascades, the reason that Carnosaur is in any of these lists is because Daniel Gershel, Gold Ducat, won a challenge with a list that had Carnosaurs in them. And he himself said, like, I'm not wedded to these Carnosaurs. I just decided to see what would happen if I put these in the flex slots. And then that just became, like, Xeroxed, you know, down the hierarchy to the point where now the most recent however many lists on Goldfish all have them, and so when you're copying a list to play in the Standard Challenge, you're going to have them too, and so on and so forth. And that's how these things kind of become memeified. Whereas I think if you were starting from scratch, you would not decide to put that card in your deck, actually.
Yeah, I mean, I think you could convince yourself, because it looks like a solution to the fact that your deck wants big spells and cheap spells. But then you cast it once, and you, like, realize that in half of the matchups, your best card is Sunfall, and in the other half, like, one of your best cards is a Negate. And even when you get to put the card into your hand, it's just, like, sorely disappointing to just have effectively cast, like, a limited level, like, six drop of, like, it drew a card. I don't know. It's just bad. Just all around bad. Don't play with it.
Yes. Let's touch on the dinosaur in the room here, I guess, which is, of course, the Domain Mirror, which we've talked about some cursed mirror matches in the show's run before. You know, the four-color Yurion mirrors in Modern. There have been a lot of good examples across the years. This one is, I mean, for all of the same reasons, honestly, that those ones were cursed, this is an incredibly cursed matchup, which by itself is going to eat up many, many hours of other people's lives, where, like, you're killing time at the end of round two of your RCQ, you see that the round clock is 8 minutes over already, and it's like, you know exactly what matchup is holding this up. And sure enough, it's the Domain Mirror. So I think you both need a, like, high-level strategic vision of what's going to happen in the game, and it's almost some games are just kind of one straight up because one player doesn't do anything. If you don't have a Beanstalk going, you can actually run out of cards and just get, like, run over by an Atraxa or whatever that sticks. But once the game reaches a certain, like, level of resources, you can almost line up the cards in both players' decks and kind of cancel them out and see what is going to happen once both players have seen their entire deck, and you know that is going to occur. And so having a plan for what am I going to do in this kind of a deck building game almost, in game one especially, because if game one is going to come down to decking potentially, even if you have a plan to win guaranteed on, like, turn 12 of the post-Cyborg games, you're not going to get to play two of those in all likelihood. So you need a good game one plan for the mirror, and to be sure that that's actually going to work if the opponent's doing the same thing. And so if, you know, you think you've got them with your main deck Jace the Perfected Mind or something, and it turns out they have the same thing going on, and you only learn that on turn 17 of game one, like, well, what are you going to do at that point?
Yeah, I was going to say, this is a classic maneuver. I forget which matchup Kyle Bogman's pioneered this for, but it was the offer the game one draw and just move to playing best 2 out of 3 sideboard. I think that there's probably enough impact to, like, having a main deck Jace for this mirror, or, like, hoping that you get the hand where, like, you just cast 3 Archangels and your opponent takes 4 each time, and you've effectively cast enough Lava Axes that they die. I don't really know if that's repeatable ever, but I think there's some equity there, but I don't think people are going to take it necessarily.
Well, then you have the arms race of, okay, I'm smart enough to have the main deck Jace, and even if I'm right that this is better than the main deck Nissa or other ways that people are kind of giving that nod to the mirror, what if they also have the main deck Jace? And then, okay, well, if I have a second Jace, is that doing a thing? On paper, yes, but you need to actually play the games to test that theory, because if often enough, like, if they find their first Jace, they're milling one of my Jaces, and then it doesn't do anything. Like, you have to actually understand how the cards line up. But even then, it's, okay, well, I have a Jace, you have a Jace, and maybe a main deck Negate or something. That one main deck Negate, again, if the game is reaching this, like, deterministic endpoint, if they just find the Negate within the first X cards of their deck, well, the game is maybe the dynamic totally changes in a way that you have to account for, and maybe it's too late to account for because you had to do that in deck building and you didn't do that, so you're dead.
Yeah, your opponent can always be one level ahead of you, for sure, at the cost of a card. I almost think the Negates are better than the Jaces, just because I have found Negate to be relatively flexible against the field at large. Like, you weirdly want Negate against basically everybody, because it counters just like a lot of random stuff that could be annoying and is a card that costs 2 mana. But yeah, I don't have a clean answer. If I had a clean answer, I would tell you what it was, because it would be simple and effective and it would instantly end the games. But yeah, it's the Domain Mirror is, I don't want to say a reason to not play the deck, but it is the biggest problem that you will probably get stuck on. Everything else is kind of just like, let's play the games. And you were like, yeah, you actually have to play the games. And it's like, how many games are you going to play in the mirror? Like two?
Yeah, so I think the Domain deck just straight up is very good, but the combined issues of the mirror being a nightmare and the deck being weirdly inflexible for how colorful it is, and then also people successfully finding ways to kind of go to the other extremes of the format to exploit it. So stuff like the Toxic deck, or as we get into this big like mess of black midrange decks, like you can pick one on the spectrum where, yeah, maybe you don't like your mid-range mirror so much, but you really like your domain matchup. So like the Domain deck, for example. And if enough people are doing that, which it seems like they are right now, it's kind of tough to know what you want to get paired against. It's like the existence of Domain forces out the stuff which just loses straight up to Domain. And so past that point, you kind of look pretty hard for any other wins on the table.
Well, I think I would move towards the black mid-range decks and point to a trend of, I think that there is a spectrum of the black mid-range decks that beats the crap out of the other black mid-range decks, but does so even when those other black mid-range decks are targeted towards Domain. And if anything, beats them because they are targeted towards Domain.
Yeah, so to be fair, you can also frame what I'm saying in the other direction of, Domain is always looming to exploit those people who try to get greedy in fighting the decks like themselves, and then it's, okay, well, your deck that has 10 billion cheap removal spells and no counter spells, well, here's Herd Migration into Up the Beanstalk into Atraxa, what up?
Yeah, it's weird. I mean, Up the Beanstalk, like, the way you're describing this, like, we're talking about this whole, like, against... I don't honestly believe that Up the Beanstalk is good against the format at large. You're just obligated to have it because of the mirrors, I think.
Yeah, it is that, and also what else are you doing with your mana that early in the game? Like, as we mentioned, unless you fully color shift into black for the black removal, which honestly might be the way to go depending on how the format moves in the next few months, if you're not going to go that far, then like, what else are you doing, right? So also, Beanstalk is at once the most important card in the mirrors, but also potentially the biggest liability past a certain point. Like, Reed was describing a game in the mirror against Seth at Worlds where, like, a slightly too hasty use of a leyline binding on Seth's part, like, was a big factor. But also just the fact that, like, Seth cast a Beanstalk that he didn't need to on, you know, turn something double digits in there and, like, just effectively instantly lost the game on the spot, even though it was going to take another double-digit number of turns for that to actually materialize, because, as we all know at this point, the card draw from Beanstalk is not optional. So that can come up against, you know, Fairy Mastermind, Shieldred, whatever, but also in the mirrors, it's like, well, yeah, I've just kind of snookered myself, because I can't cast enough spells without drawing a lethal number of cards anymore, so yeah, I'm done.
Yep, should have put that land on the bottom off of Traxa. One more card in deck.
Yeah, so... It's a mess. I mean, I won't tell people not to play Domain. Like, it is a very good deck that is a very good choice, but also, I don't know. I don't want to be that person. I'd rather fight another fight.
I sort of respect that. I want to have Domain in my pocket, but I am willing to explore the rest of the format, which is, you know, 60% of the rest of the format is black decks, and we should talk about those.
Yeah. Yeah, there's been this weird years-long debate at this point, going back to, I guess, when Meat Hook Massacre was banned over, what was it, like a year or two ago, about just this black mid-range core and how it was kind of throttling everything else. And because of the extension of the standard format legality, like, most of those cards, which would have been gone a year ago, are now around still. So you have this black core of all the best removal, so cut down, go for the throat, now Bitter Triumph, a lot of other options. You have snowballing threats, so, you know, Gix, Preacher of the Schism, a big new addition there, and once you go into other colors, you get a ton of those as well. You get good finishes at the top, so Shieldred is the nemesis of a lot of people at this point, but even stuff like Archfiend of the Dross, and then once you get up to five, you have, like, all the options under the sun, like Akrotots being the big new one against the other black decks. And then you also have the disruption that black is known for. So Duress is just like this perennial standard staple, but also Deep Cavern Bat now, as of Ixalan. Like, this is a format-defining card. Like, this is a big deal against everything, but also the bat mirrors often come down to the dynamics when one player has a bat or both players have bats back and forth. Like, this is a completely essential card to the format. And so once you kind of tally up all of that, you almost don't have room to also be heavily committed to another color. You are black X, and you get to decide what X is or what Y is if you want to have another color jammed in there as well.
Yeah, I mean, I do want to briefly touch on Preacher massively overperforming every expectation. I think, like, it's not the, like, I don't know, you read it once and you're like, okay, that's fine. And then someone explains the, like, oh, if you're tied on life thing, that's, like, you get both. And it's like, oh, that's cool. But then in practice, like, you're never tied on life. And it just doesn't matter because it's so much equity on every single attack. And, like, the sizing and death touch is just flawless for doing what it wants to do. Like, it's really hard for you. Like, I feel like there was another creature with similar sizing that we kind of discovered this with, where it's just, like, this card just, like, gets into combat and there's no efficient way to trade with it. Like, anything that's equivalent on cost, you have to double block and lose two things to the death touch. Anything that's bigger, it trades, it's already gotten advantage once it's gotten into combat. And, like, I don't know, the general worst case scenario for the card is the same as basically every other three drop.
Yeah, I mean, in a pain land format, there is actually this weird sub game over controlling your life total. And then from the other side, if they're also a pain land deck, sometimes intentionally taking damage or trying to sequence damage turns in advance so that they don't actually get both triggers at the same time. But it is weirdly easy to engineer that, like, more so than you would think. But that's almost a distraction from the fact of, even if that could never happen, the card is just still really, really good. Yeah, and the combination of four toughness and death touch means it is so difficult to actually trade off in combat profitably with that thing. And one thing that is going to become more and more clear when we talk about stuff like Rafine and Inti and some of the sizing of creatures in this format is that there are so many of the key threats where they either have more toughness than power, so left to their own devices, they just kind of bounce off each other, or as those creatures, like, outscale each other, unless you have a way to really, like, load up power artificially on a certain thing, you end up with these board stools where creatures are either the same size and can at best trade, so they just kind of stare at each other, or if you have, like, the Rafine or the Inti or something, your version of that creature is by definition bigger than theirs, so it gets to attack. So in the bat mirrors, for example, you have a bat, they have a bat, you play a Rafine or an Inti or something, well, now your bat, like, rules the skies and theirs can't attack into you anymore. But even on the ground, the ground just gets so clogged up with stuff. And so, like, you have a Schooner, which is so big that they can't attack into it. But now if you have a Preacher, their Schooner can't attack into your Preacher because it just dies, unless they also have some other way to boost its power, at which point it is still just trading because of the death touch, or, like, Gix being such a terrifying card, like, if it gets any traction whatsoever. But if they have a Gix and you have a Preacher, well, like, their Gix can't attack into your Preacher unless they have the removal spell that would let Gix snowball anyway. So basically the sizing of any ground creature really matters insofar as either your thing just gets obsoleted so quickly by everything, or your creature is a thing that is doing the obsoleting, if that makes sense. Which is why, to get the geological appraiser bashing out of the way, like, it is so nonsensical to include that card in your black-red decks. And there can be other reasons for that too, but one of the main ones is that, like, the 3-2 body, like this isn't Blood Radar for so many different reasons. And one of those reasons is your 3-2 is embarrassing in the face of anything that moves. So unless you're hoping to hit the removal spell off the appraiser that kills the thing to make your 3-2 a relevant body, it's like you're not getting the extra card worth of value from the body that you need to justify playing that card, because any like blank 3-2 in this format just doesn't really exist officially.
I have actually had a bit of the reverse, where the 3-2 body just like it doesn't matter until it does. But I think that may have been because a lot of the times I played against the Rakdos deck were explicitly with Dimir, where that deck's sizing between like the blue creatures are not sized to compete with a 3-2. And I guess we can start talking about like specific black decks by talking about Dimir. The draw of Dimir is, I think, you know, there's some amount of like Tidebinder, which is a 3-2 that trades with it. There's some amount of like Spyglass Siren being the card that enables Gix really, really well. And there's some amount of it that's just like Fairy Mastermind is a hell of a card. And like that describes a lot of things that just don't line up well against a 3-2. So I think that that is a valid excuse to put Appraiser into your deck, is if you know that your opponent's splash color in their black deck is exploitable by Appraiser.
Yeah, although a lot of the cards which would trade off or line up awkwardly against a 3-2 is... That's true if your appraiser is attacking into those, which is ideally the game state which you're trying to create with your 4-drop anyway, whereas the Spyglass Sirens and Fairy Masterminds of the world, like, yeah, they're not blocking your appraiser, but they're just attacking over it instead. And so Appraiser becomes yet another one of these cards, which is so much worse on defense or from behind than it is when you're trying to press your advantage from ahead. And if you're doing that, then I think often just cast like an Archer into the Dross or a Shieldred or something, like one of these reliably very good cards, I think that's going to be just a better route to do that a lot of the time.
Potentially, I think that there is equity in trying to beat the Dimir deck in just producing as many 2-for-1s as possible that don't run into Fairy Mastermind.
Sure. So one like mission statement of the Dimir deck is you're going lower, you have like good mana, you have fast mana, and you have these you have a 1-drop first of all in Spyglass Siren, and also Fairy Dream Thief if you want it. Like that's not unique to the Dimir deck. Like any of these black decks can start on one if they want, and we see some of these really small black red decks just starting on Fairy Dream Thief. So in theory, in your Dimir deck, you can have up to 8 flying men if you like, if you really want to commit to that bit. But the idea of I have a lot of cheap flyers, and those enhanced by like Gix, or if you're in Esper, Rafine as well, you have Shuna as this like weird thing where you have this really big ground idiot, but also a bunch of like cheap small flyers to kind of split the difference, if you like. You have this really kind of interesting diversified threat base, and also combine that with like the cheap blue permission stuff like Urtai, Tidebinder, you can run away with the game quite quickly. And against Domain, when they're giving you that time to set up, like you will start ahead and you have the tools now to press that advantage when you are ahead. So of the black mid-range decks, I think Dimir is the one which, if you're targeting Domain, like that's the way to do it. But yeah, you can suffer where against the other black decks, if they have the removal to stop the thing which is meant to be backing up your flying men, then you're just left with a bunch of flying men. And so when you're trading on a card for card basis, your flying men are not that good anymore, which then leads to the question of, is Spyglass Siren actually the card that you want? And theoretically it is if they also have a bunch of flying men, or just in general against the card Deep Cavern Bat, like Spyglass Siren is pretty nice there. But by and large, I have found that, I don't know, against the other black decks, they're killing my relevant cards often enough that I just want more relevant cards. And past a certain point, Spyglass Siren is not a relevant card anymore.
Yeah, it's one of the cards that I aggressively sideboard out. I think that you missed another advantage of Siren in that discussion, which is the way it a like double stymies aggro decks in both being a one drop and giving you ways to make a Deep Cavern Bat have two power, which is like stone cold unbeatable for anyone trying to attack you. I think that that is one of the like secret things that happens with Bat in the format, more than it just being like Mesmeric Fiend with high upside, is that like you have unlocked an alternate win condition against anyone trying to deal 20 damage directly to you. So that's pretty huge.
Yeah, that's where the sizing stuff that I mentioned like loops back in here, because the map token, which you can't guarantee most of the time that this is what you're going to get out of it, but if you can get the sizing buff at the right time, that is shockingly relevant in terms of like in the mirror, like schism stuff aside, your creature getting that +1/+1 buff just means it lines up well against their version of that creature. And so whether it's like your bat versus their bat, your siren versus their bat, you know, any mix of those, and also like you have Gix versus their Gix, or Shuna versus their Shuna, your Gix versus their Shuna, whatever it is, and then you know, Preacher and Shielded kind of scramble that math, just being big idiots with Death Touch. But yeah, the potential buff from Siren is shockingly relevant a lot of the time. And if you're not getting that buff, you're getting a card. And if you have converted your Siren into like a 1/1 draw a card, like that's pretty good as well, if those are the terms that the game's being fought on.
Yeah. I do want to point out that this whole discussion should tell you that like Fairy Dream Thief is stone cold unplayable, because all the upside of Siren is in activating the map token. The rest of it, like being a 1/1 flyer, is the worst thing the card does.
Yeah, so I would say if I'm loading up on Flying Man, like Spyglass Siren is the Flying Man that I want. And if I'm in some other black deck, which theoretically could start on Fairy Dream Thief, like Fairy Dream Thief is no Spyglass Siren. It is the lesson you learn very quickly. So I have seen these pretty radical approaches to, you know, blue-black with 8/1 drops, or even like Esper with Rafine, where you would think that's a nice setup for having 8/1 drops too. In practice, though, I just don't think it pans out that way. And I don't want to be starting on two necessarily. Like, if I don't have a bunch of Sirens, I probably want more cutdowns to compensate. But by and large, I think having my threat start on two has appealed to me a little bit more.
Yeah, I want to call out another card that is, like, vaguely linked with these as a card I don't like, and that's Rafine. Just not impressed with the card these days. I think that I don't know what the shift was. I think it may literally be the fact that Preacher and Gix both ignore cutdown, but the fact that you have suddenly exposed one of your high profile cards to their worst removal spell, either cutdown or destroy, is pretty bad. Like the fact that it hits turn five and you just legally aren't allowed to attack with your Rafine creature into Shieldred, is kind of a problem. I've not been impressed by it. I don't like what it does to your mana. I mean, it's not a huge problem, but it's just enough of an annoyance that it just isn't worth the upgrade to me over, like, I don't really know what you're accomplishing by playing Rafine in addition to Preacher. Like, I don't really know what the card offers that Preacher and Gix don't. Like, not being actually tangibly up cards on, like, your small ball games with Rafine. And then, like, this whole discussion we had about one drops, and also, like, the duality of, like, adding one drops to maximize the chances of getting a bigger connive on an early Rafine also exacerbates those mana issues I was talking about. It just has not looked good in any of the games I've played for the most part.
Okay, so I have complicated thoughts back and forth on Rafine. So there is the larger criticism of when the three drops you get in mono black are so good, and maybe the question there is mono black just a viable strategy in this space as well? Like, we can circle back to that at some point maybe, but when you have Gix and Preacher now too, and Rafine and Gix are kind of working in a similar space and either competing or cooperating with each other, depending on how you see it. Like, yeah, the idea of splashing for a triple color three drop when you can just, like, keep it simple, stupid, and play those, you wonder if it's worth the effort. And that goes across the board too. So like these Golgari decks, right? Yeah, Sentinel and Glissa are both very strong cards for what they are, and in any other Golgari deck in any other format, those would be like big reasons to be in those colors. But you could just play Gix and play creature in your Golgari deck anyway, and at that point, like, what is the green really getting you, right? So there is that just general criticism of all the other three drops that exist, and that does apply still to Ravine. What I will say though is, so currently I've been playing effectively blue black splash Ravine off four plaza and a bunch of other lands in my Dimir deck, and have liked that setup a fair amount. And what I found is, so firstly, like, Gix is messed up when it's good, and Ravine pushes you towards the same incentives as Gix does, so you get to like double dip on that. But they're also very good together. Like one issue that I've always had with Ravine is, if you're not actually going up on cards in the first place, then often conniving is pretty painful, because like, you want some of these lands, but you also want your spells, and if you want the power and toughness buff from conniving, then you're discarding your relevant spells, and you're left with a bunch of lands. So having a thing which, like, the first wave puts you up on cards, and then if they have to kill the Gix, and they do have to kill the Gix, then the Ravine like has more stuff to be working with. But also, the thing which I was struggling to articulate about Ravine until I realized the whole sizing thing was that when the power buff and the toughness buff like really matters in a very granular way, like every point is a relevant threshold, then Ravine actually like is the thing that breaks you through these otherwise stalled boards in a way that the other three drops can't really hope to do. Like, Preacher can just by itself being annoying, but if, you know, if stuff is going on in the air, for example, like these bat fights or whatever it is, well, Ravine is a big flyer that's hard to kill, which also makes your big flyers relevantly, or your small flyers relevantly bigger at the same time. And just the, even just the curve of like Shuna into Ravine is really nice. Like, the card is still, in my experience, as messed up as ever. I mean, in conjunction with Shieldred, it's still messed up too. And yeah, their Shieldred is really good, but their Shieldred is always really good. And one way to deal with their Shieldred is to bite the bullet and just pay six and like actually dig for your answers. And Ravine still lets you do that. So I don't know. I've been very impressed by Ravine, and I couldn't really put into pieces why that was until like actually sitting down and working through the literal numbers on the cards. But yeah, I've liked Ravine a lot. I've also just like clean straight Dimir a lot, but my current split the difference of blue black only splashing Ravine has that's felt like a nice compromise to me. That said, you can also pick your spot in the Esper color wheel here, so you can be blue black splash Ravine, you can be I know some people are trying black-white splash Ravine, basically. You can be blue-white splash Ravine, or you can just do the whole hog and just be full Esper. And there are so many good mana-fixing lands across the three colors that it's kind of messy. You've got to figure it out, but like it does work. It's functional. So you can pick your spot there. I think what people have realized is the heavy white focus from before, so like Virtue of Loyalty, Wedding Announcement, Wandering Emperor, in a world where there are so many good three drops and increasingly people are like taking to the skies, just the relative merit of Wedding Announcement has kind of gone down. Like, it just doesn't dominate as much as it used to. And it like also pairs kind of awkwardly with stuff like Shuna and isn't really great against Shuna either. It's just more awkward than it used to be. That said, if people are moving to like black red to try and get ahead in the black mirrors, well, Wedding Announcement is still as messed up against black red as it ever has been as well. So I don't know, there's still room to be flexible there. But if you said going into this RCQ season, I am going to play Esper of some kind, but I have my Esper box of all of the different like cards in these colors that I could conceivably play, and I'm going to stay on top of the format, I think that would be a very good place to be, because some form of Esper is always going to be at least good and often great. Whereas a deck like Domain, which superficially should be more flexible, but in practice it just really isn't. I could see Domain getting edged out more in a way that like Esper is always going to be, you know, or some form of deck like that is always going to be 15 to 20% plus and for good reason.
Yeah, I mean, I think I want to point out another, like, you talk about Domain. I would point to that as one of the reasons to not play the white cards. I know that people try to find a lot of ways to make the Azorius decks defeat Domain, but realistically, they are just all worse than the equivalent Dimir deck is at doing the exact same thing. Like, I think that some of your description of, like, yeah, well, you can Wedding Announcement out the Rakdos decks, that works against the ones that are not just, like, secretly also Domain, but not so much against the ones that are just like, I don't know, I'm going to play another 7-drop, and I'll play another 7-drop, and then maybe a third one, and that's probably better. But there's one white card, so even as someone who hates Ravine and doesn't want to touch the white cards as much as possible, there is exactly one that gives me a little bit of interest, and that is Destroy Evil. I am not here necessarily for Destroy Evil in the way that, like, some people have kind of... I feel like there's a lot of spots where it ends up in sideboards where it doesn't belong, but I think that's a symptom of it being so good when it is supposed to be in your deck, that it just ends up in decks that it shouldn't be in. But, like, the way that it exists and cleans up, like, oh, it's both a way to kill their Atraxa and kill them because their Atraxa is no longer on the battlefield, but also, like, it's a way to kill their Leyline Bending and remain proactive. It's powerful in mirrors in a lot of spots because it kills, you know, Preacher, Rafine, Schooner, Shieldred, like, all of these cards. Any excuse that you could, like, I don't know, there's just, like, a lot of, like, really good things that it cleanly mops up. Like, we were talking about, like, all these Azorius cards, like, yeah, it just kills the entire relevant spectrum of the Azorius stack. That card is really good in small numbers, and if you are actually stretching to white more than just, like, I am playing four Plaza Heroes and the literal bare minimum number of other white sources, I would make sure to potentially probably have two in the 75 and up to one in my main deck.
Yeah, I do like Destroy Evil a lot. It is the thing that I've felt the loss of most acutely from kind of minimizing my white commitment. Is like, I want Destroy Evil, but I can't really have it, I think, if I'm being honest with myself. That said, I think it's a little oversold. Like, it's very good against Domain. Like, I want it a lot against Domain. If I'm in blue-white, then I need it against Domain because I need some removal. And also, conveniently, it hits their Bindings and their Beanstalks and whatever. But I think in the black midrange fights, it gets a little bit oversold because often it is just go for the throat, but in a more conditional way where it's also, like, yeah, it's not hitting their Gix, and if it's not hitting their Gix, like, that's kind of terrifying. If it's not hitting their 2-drop, which they're then training into Gix, like, that's pretty bad. I want to be able to pop a bat with it to get my actual relevant card back, and Destroy Evil can't do that. So unless we're going back to an era where it's Wedding Announcements and Virtues left and right, and killing those is really key in those pseudo-mirrors, then it's good, but it's still more conditional than I would like, I think. And then you get to the thing of, like, against the aggro decks, it sometimes can do stuff. Like, it against mono red, I Destroy Evil there, Kamano faces Kakuzan or something. But, like, you get into spots where if it doesn't do what you need it to do, then that is a, like, catastrophic failure in the card. And I don't know. So to me, if I'm in full Esper or blue white or white X already, I will have some Destroy Evils, but it's not alluring enough that I'm going to go out of my way to find ways to put that card in my deck.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I am excited about it when it is, like, your seventh removal spell and you are just finding a place to put it instead. Like, when there are lists where, like, I don't know, it feels like there's a lot of decks where, like, they just play Destroy Evil as their, like, first through third removal spells, and that's a problem when it doesn't kill a thing. But when it's like, yeah, I've got, like, two cut downs and my fourth go for the throat is also a Destroy Evil, that's when it's like, I don't know, I'm just gonna, like, put the Destroy Evil in front of the thing that Destroy Evil exactly kills, and then put my go for the throat in front of their Gix that exactly go for the throat kills. Putting yourself into that position is when it's maximized.
Yeah, I want to have the ability to line up my cards in that way, but the issue comes when sometimes Destroy Evil is your first or your only removal spell left once they, like, bat the first one or something, and then if it's not doing the job, then that's pretty bad. So let's, I guess, touch on the the other colors that show up alongside these black cards. So Golgari, first of all, it is worth noting, in a format where the, just because of longevity, if nothing else, the mana for every color combination is basically the best that it ever has been. That is more true of allied colors than it is for the enemy color still. And I don't know how much of a cost not having, I guess, Blooming Marsh in this case is versus, you know, Blackleaf Cliffs in Rakdos or Darkdeck Shores in Dimir. I think it is a real cost. It's not a fatal one, but, you know, the mana is not quite as smooth with your, like, man land plus slow land plus pain land mana base as it is in Dimir, where you just have, like, completely seamless mana up the curve.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's especially notable in Golgari because, like, the cards that cost single green are the random 3-drops replacing black cards that you could already play. And then Mosswood Dread Knight, which we'll get to in a second. But then, like, all these decks have, like, 2 Titanias and a Nissa in their deck that's just short green sources. And it's like, how are you casting these? I think that when you say, is mono black a viable strategy, Golgari is actually the proof of concept there. Because the deck should just not be playing any of the green cards, it feels like, for the most part. I love Dread Knight. I think that there's a few problems with it in this format and in Constructed in general. I think that the first problem is that I don't think this is the scale of card advantage you really want. I think that it's a card that, like, is at its best in formats that are a little more paced out, where you are more reliably wanting to cast the adventure on the other side, even when you, like, there's obviously some amount where it's like, oh yeah, I have my second Dread Knight, it's whatever, but, like, I feel like there's a little more urgency in just, like, getting the good cards out of your hand in this format and not just, like, getting stuck with, like, 2-3 drops on turn 5 in a way that trading off Dread Knight doesn't allow. There's just, like, the bad externality of, like, you are not allowed to cast Dread Whisperers when your opponent controls Fairy Mastermind, which is...
Right.
Fairy Mastermind is a messed up card. I'm just going to probably say that another 2 to 3 times. That card is just really, really good. And, like, traditional cards that say draw a card are distinctly worse because it exists.
I was worried for Yuta, like, for a hot minute that he would get a card and it would be unplayable. But I'm now that his card is actually, like, been very solidly good in Standard for, like, 6 months straight, and now people are playing Standard, so they get to realize that.
Yeah, no, I think this is, like, a flawless Magic design for him. I'm, you know, we can just go back to feeling bad for Javier for having the, like,
yeah,
you know, technically EDH friendly, you equip some, you know, commander set equipment to it for free card. This, you know, Fairy Mastermind is the real deal on, like, every single level.
Yes, I'm very glad that I was able to get Yuta to sign a set for me at Worlds and that I will get to play those. Currently, I am in my Slowgoke era, but when I actually am taking the format seriously again, you know, I will get some mileage out of those, I'm sure.
Yeah, so and I guess my last counterpoint about Golgari, for what it's worth, is that Raja played it at the NRG, which is, like, simultaneously, like, the biggest endorsement and condemnation of a mid-range deck possible, because Raja loves a good mid-range deck, but also somehow is just, like, known for having the, like, worst possible mid-range decks on his resume and winning a bunch of them anyways. So take that as you will.
Yeah, the man has range. He either plays control decks, like, relatively flawlessly, or he's playing, as they are affectionately known, like, black-white Rajas, Golgari Rajas, just something Rajas, like, brackets derogatory. And we mentioned, you know, it's kind of tough to justify these other colors in a world where, like, black has the good 3-drops or whatever. If you look at a Raja deck, you will discover 3-drops you didn't know existed. Like, you will learn things about the card pool that you would never learn otherwise. But it does, yeah, you look at the... Certainly, we're not in a Blossoming Tortoise phase anymore. You can just play the good black 4-drops instead. But even just lower down, right? Like, yeah, Sentinel Glisser, phenomenal cards. But Gix and Preacher, also phenomenal cards. So if I'm in green, I will at least consider my options here and maybe have a spread of these to, you know, to mix and match. But, like, to me, these are not drawing me into green in the first place. These are not a reason to be in green. So... And this goes for the Rakdos decks too. It feels like the 2-drops, more than anything else, are the reason to be in whatever this second color is, whether it's you know, Mastermind or you know, and or Malcolm and Schooner and Staff in blue, it's Bloodtithe Harvester and Inti in red, or it's specifically Mosswood Dreadknight in green. But as you mentioned, the idea of just grinding people out with this card feels a lot more remote than you wanted to. And as I keep saying, a 3-2 body just really isn't what it used to be, like on the ground. So if both halves are losing their luster, then Dreadknight itself doesn't stand out. And at that point, like, why are we in green exactly? Like, okay, Restless Cottage is great, but so are the other black manlands at this point. So what are we getting by being in green specifically? And I guess it's if artifacts and enchantments are good, then you have a bunch of good naturalizes, but we could also just be in those colors that have the good artifacts and enchantments instead. So yeah, I just don't really see the pull into Golgari right now. And then you get into the issue of, well, the domain matchup, and are we actually favored against the other black decks, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you said 3-2 bodies. I still think Bloodtithe Harvester goes hard. I mean, it's not like quite like it used to be, but that card's really, really good. And I think that there's like maybe a little bit of a gap there in like the 3-2 body that requires mana investment and additional things to get the value, as opposed to the one that's just like, here it is all up front in whatever order you want it.
Yeah, so maybe this is a good time to move on to the Rados decks then, because the ones that are small enough do care about Bloodtithe Harvester. I do think it is a big draw to those, and part of that is that if the 3-2 is bad, well, the removal spell can sometimes be good, and in these Bat Mirrors specifically, Bloodtithe Harvester kind of breaks those open in the sense of, like, if they play Bloodtithe Harvester, you can't like bat their good 3-drop because they just kill your bat, get their 3-drop. So if their 3-drop is Gix, you do kind of delay the inevitable because they're not attacking and then getting a trigger. They're kind of like just playing a naked Gix, and that's fine. But if your hand is weak to their Preacher, for example, you can't like bat on 2 and take their Preacher because, well, they're just getting it right back. And the same goes for, you know, their Shieldred or their Liliana or whatever it is. And Liliana is an interesting one, but we haven't covered yet, and I don't think the other black decks want or need it all that much. But in specifically Rakdos, when you have Harvester to set that up and more removal in general, and like even plussing it when you have Inti is pretty nice if you're that small. Like, it's almost a like gold Rakdos card, but actually like surprisingly good in that role sometimes. But yeah, Bloodtithe just killing Bat by itself, like, that is a big draw to the card. These like random creature decks that people are trying to get under domain, just popping off their Rot Priest or their Skrelv or something, like, all of that is nice. And then you know, the blood token isn't nothing either, and because you also have Inti and stuff, like, sometimes your 3-2 gets upgraded to a 4-3, which is a much more relevant stat line. So yeah, I think Bloodtithe still is great, and also Inti we should touch on too, because like everything people have said about it in other formats is true, but also the specific like sizing stuff about Standard, like Inti breaks that open too. So yeah, Inti is great, Bloodtithe is great, that is why you're in red. And it feels like people are putting these appraisers in the deck because, well, it's a red card, so while we're here we may as well. When I think if like you have the two premium black 4-drops in Archfiend, in Shieldred, which the Pioneer Rados deck is debating over which of those to include, like, just please play those instead. Like, those are very good in general, they're very good here, just play the good cards, don't get cute with it.
Yeah, well, I mean, can we start by cutting the Carnosaurs and then move on to okay, cutting the appraisers?
Okay, so yeah, this is where the spectrum of these black red decks really matters, and I'm begging everyone for our collective sanity, please communicate clearly about what you mean when you say, for example, how is your Rakdos matchup? I just got paired against Rakdos. Or same thing for Esper, right? How's your Esper matchup? Well, I don't know. Esper can mean 10 different things. Like, what kind of Esper are we talking about? Like, you really have to go beyond the color combination and be specific about what the deck is trying to do. And so, you know, the Bloodtithe Inti deck that I'm talking about, very different from big black red or black red dinos, whatever you want to call it, where, yeah, if you are trying to breach into a Tali or vice versa, that is a different game that you are playing from you know, the small ball, like, two drops into three drop stuff. And then in between, you have this quite popular variant of Rakdos where it's, like, all of the small stuff, but also, like, Cruelty of Gix, Carnosaur, Appraiser, which... The Cruelty thing makes Appraiser even more heinous, by the way. Like, at least play a high-impact 4-drop that does the thing that it says on the card when you get it back with your Chapter 3, and not the card which... whatever. Anyway. Yeah, you can talk me into... I think the small black-red deck is just very good. The big one... I played this against CCR on his stream the other day, just to, at Jarvis's request, like, put it through his paces, and I think it does a job of beating Domain, but I also don't think the deck actually functions as a deck, so I would really strongly shy away from that one. And then the one in between, I get the idea of being slightly bigger than the other black midrange decks, but this one is just playing bad cards to do it, as you identify. So, like, yeah, just play the good cards, and then you can top out with some cruelties or some bad gods or whatever it is, but just play the good cards up the curve, and there are enough of those that you can do that without having to bloat the curve at the top, and then just see where things take you from there.
Yeah, I don't know. I would sum this up all as, like, friends don't let friends play Cruelty of Gix, as we have learned many times before, but you may have different opinions.
No, I have learned that the hard way. Yeah, and have tried to stop others relearning that the hard way and failed. So I am particularly gun-shy on that card. I do think it's actually a somewhat solid sideboard card out of these smaller Rakdos decks against the bigger ones and against Domain. But as a starting point, yeah, I think you can probably do better.
Yeah, it's... What you are attempting to put together is, like, not quite... I don't know. You just get so much better for 5 mana than whatever the heck this is trying to approximate.
Yeah, I mean, I get better for 4 mana, and then if my Cruelty is getting back my good 4-drop, then we can have a conversation. But if it's, like, jerry-rig my 6-drop into my graveyard so I can Cruelty that at a discount so that then the 6-drop can maybe hit one of the good 4-drops that should be in my deck instead of it, then whatever, just keep it simple.
Yeah, how do you feel about the even bigger Rakdos deck, the one that has, like, Breach as opposed to, like, whatever mix of small things you want, and then also Trumping Carnosaur?
Yeah, so that's the one that I think just doesn't actually work as a deck for the most part. I think the issue is you just don't have... It's kind of the scape shift issue of you just don't actually have enough cardboard to cast your spells consistently, because you're not going up on cards, and if your setup play is something like Big Score, which is still card neutral kind of, but you have to get to the big score, which feels like a stretch goal in itself sometimes, and that's a card which is bad in the face of, like, Mage Disappear, Fairy Mastermind, if nothing else is. And then once you're there, you then cast your top end, but your top end isn't deterministic. It's reveal the top X cards of whatever, or cascade, or discover, and then there's still, like, this fail rate that can creep in there. So you're jumping through a lot of hoops to then spin the wheel and hope that you high roll in a way that I, like, if you can do that, great, but I think it's just not a safe enough recipe for me to be comfortable with.
Fair enough. Your 7-drops are much more reliable if you have all 5 colors of mana supporting them.
Well, yeah, and also if you have, like, actual ramp, or if Atali had, like, basic land cycling or something, then maybe we could talk, but it's just getting your cards in the right zones and getting enough of the right cards is just... it's so impossible, it feels like, sometimes. And that's leaving aside this, like, Field of Ruin nonsense, which I guess if sometimes you get paired against these decks with one basic and you double stoning them into the ground, and okay, fine. But the whole issue with the deck is not having enough time to do anything relevant. And if you are spinning your tires, trying to make them spin their tires, then you're just leaning into that issue. So, yeah, this deck is... you would have to fundamentally retool it for me to have any interest. And at that point, like, we're talking about something different. So come back to me when you've done that. You can talk me into Cruelty of Gix again. But for now, I'm out.
Yeah, I guess you mentioned being in your Slowgurk era, and I honorably consider this a, like, black midrange deck. Do we have any brief thoughts on the CFT Sock Legends deck, aside from the fact that it now has an actual infinite?
Yes, yeah, so we were just ahead of our time, I guess. At the point where we asked, does this have an infinite, the answer was no. But now that the one Ludovic has been added to the deck, the answer is now yes. Would you care to speculate on why that is possible now?
I know the answer. Okay. It basically, like, this is the infinite that when your, like, finite combo draws your deck, this is how you go true infinite to show them they're actually dead, is my understanding, basically.
Yeah, so if you can transform Ludovic into a Rona, then you can have a Rona and a fake Rona in play at the same time. And at that point, there are Slowgurk, Otawara, Takanuma, Ashnod, the one mana legend loops that you can go through, which when both Ronas can tap for mana with Relic of Legends, now you're actually like netting a mana with each iteration in a way that you couldn't before, and then you figure it out from there. So you can cross that bridge when you get to it. Getting to the point where you have assembled and registered the Slowgurk deck, and you have survived long enough to get to this point in the game without winning already, and you are now going through the motions of this loop. It reminds me of how people fixated on like the Mirror Retriever stuff in KCI when that was by far the least relevant part of the deck, and you could cut it all together and not really lose anything. Like, I don't know if the Ludovic or the Ashnod should be in the deck in the first place, or really if anything else should be. I am not qualified to weigh in on this, but the deck is cool as hell, and from my lofty perch as having my RC invite already and still getting to play RCQs, this is the perfect deck to while away an afternoon with, I think.
I think that's valid. The just like general Slowgurk interaction where you just like have Slowgurk and Rona, and then like there are Odawaras and Takanumas moving between zones repeatedly, that has been really impressive when I've seen it in action. That said, I am less skeptical of this deck on the engine level and more skeptical of it on the level of like, I don't want to be the low interaction black deck in the format of like every black deck and also domain is vaguely forcing me to want to be more interactive just because of the presence of like all the reasons we stated to be like, you have to disrupt domain after having an aggressive start, and then also like deep cavern bat.
Yeah, and that's why if I'm building this deck, it's with more interaction. So I ideally four go for the throw in the main deck, at least one card down, and going to be able to board up to four card downs in the 75, and effectively play like a much more boring black midrange deck when the situation calls for it, and then still get to do all the cool stuff that drew you in the first place when those removal spells ideally have bought you the time to do that. I think that's the way to kind of square the circle there.
Yeah, I struggle with the idea of like not just playing the more interactive deck to begin with and boarding in independent engines when I need that.
Yeah, I and this is the eternal struggle with that kind of like heavily committal engine deck, right? I mean, I think this one has a little bit of flexibility in that regard, and I think you could also, for example, board into, you know, some more Shieldreds and Titanians and stuff, and just four Glisser. Like, you can be what the Golgari deck wants to be almost in a weird way, and then you do the thing which I'm gonna take on good faith from Jason and CFT Sock, like it does go over the top of domain successfully and so on. I'm hoping that's the case, but yeah, I think the pressing issue, as you say, is like surviving against the more boring black decks long enough to do that, and I think that's doable though. I think that's realistic.
Okay, I will allow you to continue to chase that. What card type is Slowgurk? Slime Horror?
It's got to be a frog, right?
No. That's the discussion in the Discord. It's Grolnok. It's Slowgurk has to be a slime, but I don't know if it has other types because it's the Ogre Slime.
It is. Apparently.
Yeah, I think this goes back to a long-standing complaint about what is and isn't a like noble, and like Slowgurk not being a noble is a new one on the list.
Yeah, I feel like Dragon Warrior Monsters or Dragon Quest really figured out the whole like slime taxonomy 25 years ago, and we've all just been copying their homework ever since then.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah, Slowgurk deserves to be a noble. New thing I will be tweeting at WotC staff repeatedly throughout 2024. continuing on.
No, they have a lot worse shit being tweeted at them on the daily basis. So you're fine, I think.
Okay, fair enough. Are there any other black midrange decks that we haven't covered? I guess maybe the like Mentor Helping Hand shells, but I think a lot of that kind of falls under the same camp of like, I don't really understand why were like playing bad cards to enable Rafine in our like decks when we could just like play a normal card that does a lot of the same that this other card that we're trying to go all in on does.
Yeah, once that Will Urca creation got second in the challenge, I saw literal dozens of people ordering cards for that deck, and I have not seen a single result from that deck to really write home about since then. So that may be a flash in the pan that the basis people, to the tune of, I don't know, $10 in store credit or whatever a set of Haughty Gins is worth these days.
Yeah, you know, that is one of those cards that is worth approximately $1.50 until people decide to buy all of them, and then it is worth $3.30.
Yeah, so, and, yeah. Get your MTG Finance speculation in early here. Beyond that, there's Soldiers is still a deck to some degree, and it exists in that same kind of flash-heavy, disruptive, aggro-control kind of space that is meant to be preying on Domain, which I think it does, but also it has kind of these same issues that it's had against the black midrange decks, kind of exacerbated by Preacher. Like, Preacher is a really mess up card against a lot of people, but against Soldiers in particular. And the deck is like quite agile and flexible in sideboarding, but I think you end up with these very disjointed draws a lot of the time where, you know, against this black midrange deck post board, it's like, okay, well, I have this recruitment officer that's not doing anything. That's going to get hit in for two and then die. I destroy Evil Your First Thing, and then I play my Takati's Welcome, but I don't have any creatures left in my hand anymore. And I didn't really have a chance to leave out mana for this mate disappear at any point. And it's just each angle of the deck kind of asks enough of you that you can't get a coherent whole, it feels like, some of the time. So I think there's still something there, but I don't know if the actual like soldier stuff is worth a squeeze anymore. And on that note, you do also see some straight blue-white decks. So there's one player who has had a pretty absurd conversion rate in these Modo challenges, essentially playing a Haynes blue-white like Regal Bunnycorn Invasion of Segovia deck from Worlds, but which has had some nice upgrades in the form of, you know, Warden and Schooner and so on. And this is also a deck which I will pay close attention to when the new set comes out, because Thraven Inspector, like the idea of 4 Warden, 4 Thraven Inspector, 4 Spyglass Siren, that feels like a pretty nice starting point to flesh out, you know, however I like with.
Yeah, I don't know. I voiced my complaints about like this deck feeling like it is doing a worse version of what the Demir decks are doing in terms of like trying to build something instead of the cards just killing its opponent outright. But that doesn't mean it hasn't felt powerful across the table. I do want to throw one more stray back at Soldiers, which is that like any deck where Invasion of Gobicon is a stock card in your deck is probably doing the wrong thing.
Yeah, I mean, you are allowed to just cut that card from your deck and perhaps should be encouraged to as well. But yeah, don't let that one card sully yet another deck's entire reputation.
Yeah, so I guess talking about Soldiers, we're starting to broach into the last small segment of the metagame, which is the like true aggressive decks, which are basically, there's two decks. There's red, and then there's the Bant Toxic deck, which I keep calling Infect, but like it's decidedly not Infect. It is, if you treat this deck like Infect, you will just lose to it. It's like almost, I want to say it's like in the middle ground between like a Delver deck and the Andrew Ellenbogen mono white deck. It's really weird and hard to place anywhere besides exactly where it sits with like having played against the cards.
Yeah, I was skeptical of it when I just saw it on paper. It feels like the kind of thing which it does its one job very well for a weekend, and then once people understand that it exists, like very quickly gets forced out. Having played against it a few times, I'm now a little more impressed by it, but also quite confused. Like it seems like it really shouldn't work, and yet it just about gets across the finish line, like just often enough, I think. I don't really have any interest in playing it myself, but I kind of get why people would, if that makes sense.
Nope, that all lines up. I believe my exact contradictory opinion of it is that it is better than you think it is, and also grossly exploitable.
Yeah, I think people try to do that in the wrong ways, though, right? Where, like, it almost reminds me of the early days of Convoke in Pioneer, where, yeah, if you're trying to keep up on a one-for-one basis, you're not going to do well, and especially if it's just, like, removal spells that are more expensive than their one thing, but sometimes you just you make a big idiot and they just don't do anything anymore. Like, if you ever played a Glisser against the Toxic deck, it's just, it feels utterly humiliating.
It's not even, you don't even need to go up to the Glisser point. Like, my opponents have, like, when you're like, yeah, 3/2s on two are just, like, not impressive, I'm like, oh, no, no. But if you're playing Toxic, you can just never defeat being on the draw against a 3/2. Your creatures all have one power, and they just play a 3/2, and you're like, huh. Well, they're going to play a 2/4 next turn. Can't beat either of those. It's over. But the games where you, like, have your one drop cut down, and then you play a Skrell's Hive, and then your opponent, like, plays a Fairy Mastermind, and then you play another 1/1 and, like, a spell, like, those are the games you just get out and shred your opponent.
Yeah, so this is the kind of deck which really does viscerally appeal to a lot of people. So after that breakout weekend, I'd expect to see a decent amount of it in the next week or two. If you fast forward like another 2 or 3 weeks, I don't know how true that will be. So I guess play the waiting game on that one. I guess we can finish this quick tour of Standard then with the mono red deck, which, again, depending on where you are playing Standard and who with, this is like the number one menace in the format. Don't know who Domain is, never heard of her. Mono red is the menace destroying us all. Or it's just yet another deck which people will play and win like low 40 percentage points with. And yeah, it hasn't really gained much, and it feels like all the new best cards that get printed are pretty good against it at the same time.
Yeah, I think that the mono red deck as it's constructed in like the 18 mountain sense right now is stone unplayable. I think the big immediate hurdle that needs to be solved before you even get anywhere else with figuring out like what the deck is supposed to do is that it's just illegal to play two drops and three drops that die to Archangel of Wrath triggers. You just cannot be doing that, and you have to rebuild the deck entirely so that you don't instantly lose the game when your opponent taps 5 mana and casts that card.
Yeah, I think more broadly, like the Archangel math, it's tough to pass, right? Because dodging the first shock from it, some amount of it is priced in if you're a creature deck of some kind. So like, yeah, you want to play Deep Cavern Bat and Fairy Mastermind. You do that with the understanding that if they get to the point of Archangel, then they're going to shoot down your thing. That's just the cost of doing business. They're two drops. What do you expect? I mean, maybe what you expect is your Shuna, which if you can pump it once, is like very good in the face of Archangel. But going up the curve, it does matter a lot. Like your three drops and your four drops, do they survive 4 damage from an Archangel or not? And that can get messy too. So like, does Rafine count as that? Kind of. The mid-range decks have to deal with that question in their own ways for each of their threats. For the aggro decks, that is like, that's an existential threat. Like, if your cards just don't line up well against Archangel, you might like your Domain matchup, but if you can neutralize the main way that that deck stabilizes and beats you, then that's the difference between, I think I like my matchup, but if I'm on the draw, I don't even know about that, to, yeah, I actually have like an iron grip on the most popular matchup in the format.
Yeah, and that's part of why Bant is so effective, is that, like we said, it does not care about life gain on any of these threats. I have been relatively impressed in just the literal, like, playing against Domain sense by the Gruul version of the red deck that is, like, the Giant Growth Audacity deck that is largely just Monastery Swift Spear, where, like, when your opponent plays an Archangel and tries to do 2 damage, you have 8,000 different ways to not have your thing die to it. I've been really impressed by that and kind of want to explore it more. I've been, like, anti-impressed with the Boros deck that is, I would describe it as, like, vastly unplayable because it leans even further into this. Like, I think one of the big takeaways is I don't want Inti in my red decks just because of the Archangel issue, where like I felt like it is relatively easy for my Domain opponents to just like set the game up in such a fashion that an early Inti ends up getting Wrathed and a late Inti is just insta dead. So I'm just kind of off the presence of that card in red decks, and the Boros deck is like all in on Inti to some degree of like it's just like in this weird strain. Also, like, there's no inspiring advantage, so I don't even know how you're putting these cards together.
Yeah, I mean, are we talking about like the human sex that can lean on Courtyard and Cabinet Souls and so on, or something else?
I have seen a range of these decks that are like, there's Imodane Recruiter in their deck.
Sure.
Yeah, I would describe the humans deck, like, whether you play Coppercoat Vanguard or a different 2-drop in your deck does not really matter in the face of the problem set.
Yeah, I mean, that's another deck which gets a nice little shot in the arm from new Thraven Inspector as well. But it is a sign of the times, I think, that the decks like that, so thinking of the humans decks in particular, those are really good aggro decks. Like, if you put those in most formats where an aggro deck is playable, they will just clean up and they make other like white aggro decks similar to those look embarrassing. And yet, in the context of this format, it still feels like they are just pushing their boulder up the hill over and over again. Like, the just underlying conditions are just pretty hostile, I think, where all the black midrange decks are inherently kind of hostile to these creature decks, and then the ramp deck of choice just has like 10 incidental life gain cards in it as well, and some of the best sweepers of all time. It's just, it's a lot to fight through. I don't know.
Yeah, this is, again, another reason I like the Giant Growth deck, is that you can just choose to have the game cease at some point before your opponent starts taking the scary game actions.
Mm-hmm. So with all that in mind, then, if you had an RCQ this coming weekend, and maybe the answer changes if it's this weekend versus next weekend or whatever, and, you know, the much vaunted card access issues do not apply, what are you sleeping up? What are you going with?
I would be playing Domain until the paper players have demonstrated that they are properly respecting it. Which may be too much disrespect, but that's kind of where I'm at.
Mm-hmm. My non-committal answer is, I'm here for a good time, so I'm playing Slowgurk. If I want to be there for a long time, I would default to the list of Esper, so, you know, Dimir, Splashing Morphine, effectively, that I've been liking, unless I had enough time to try like the small black red deck, you know, just with the good cards. And if I can get that list to a point where I like it, then it becomes a question of how bad is this versus Domain. Like, that's the main sticking point, and how much is that an issue at this point in time, and probably just Esper is still a safe default at that point. Yeah, that's basically where my head is at. And going forward, I will be posting more information about that, and also like lists and detailed, you know, primers, cyborg guides, on a separate Patreon, if people are committed to the standard grind and want like up-to-date information from someone who actually is in the trenches. I will be providing that for the people at home, and also as well with that, things like you know, whatever the format of choice is. So we have modern RCs coming up too. Whatever your questions are about Amulet or other things, I am not a one trick entirely, as it turns out. So detailed information there as well. And just, you know, thoughts on competitive Magic. I have a lot of those. Would like to have a platform to, yet another platform to spurt those out onto. So we'll send people that direction as well. So links to all of these things that we've mentioned, all these various resources there in the show notes. In the meantime, though, it wouldn't be an episode without a Nonsense of the Week segment. This one, not standard just yet, although, one could argue the Legends deck has taken care of that for us. Let's move on to Pioneer, and this is another, this list is from Bilsiv, but this is actually another deranged CFT stock creation, I believe.
Really? Yes. I just saw this deck and immediately thought Enchantees with 25% less Enchantees.
Well, often, if you are on CFT Sox NPG Goldfish page, you'll see many things, including, for example, 19 land Yawgmoth with Utopia Sprawl is the most recent entry. Going down beyond that, you know, four color legends, but Pioneer, 5-color Enigmatic Incarnation, which that could mean a lot of things already these days, but it turns out that what it means for them right now is this is effectively blue-white control splashing like this Enigmatic Incarnation package with Fable and so on. So you look at like the spell half of this deck, 4 Dovin's Veto, 4 Memory Deluge, we got some Get Lost, Make Disappears, Supreme Verdict, Sunfall, 2 Teferi Hero of Dominaria. So this is, you know, nothing to see here, right? This is just good old blue-white Yorion. And then looking over, you know, Omen of the Sea, Temporary Lockdown, seen all of this before, But then you see three enigmatic incarnation, and then that diverts your eyes to the creature section, which in most blue white Yorion decks, that one is empty, or maybe there's like a dream trawler or something just hanging out by itself. Here you have the, at this point, CFT Sock signature, two Bonecrusher Giant, and then a Gloomshrieker, a Night of Autumn, a Wandering Mind, a Heliod of the Radiant Dawn, an Omnath Locus of Creation, and then we got to have two bullets here for our binding to Enigmatic into. So we've got an Agent of Treachery and an Atraxa Grand Unifier, which I guess we are in all of the wrong colors. Oh, okay, hold up. There is one Xander's Lounge as a natural black source for the Atraxa. And if our Fable token gets attacked, we can make some treasure. Like, we'll figure it out. But there's no Fires of Invention making us do it the hard way here. I guess there is a Swamp as well for copies of Fable Passage. Which,
and there's given one that we have the Triome.
Okay. I'm setting it short here. So I guess given that we have only one Omnath in our 80 cards, then the usual thing of, oh shit, I drew my Swamp doesn't really come up as often, but still not a great card to draw, but at least taps for colorless-ish mana here.
Well, can I tell you that it might come up when you board in the other two Omnaths and just give up on the Enchantes plan to some degree? Or move but in on it? It's hard to tell what they're there for.
Yeah, I think the other Omnath, that may be a Bilsiv tweak to this deck. I guess it's Omnath is a good card, so we could just add more of them, which they let you do in the main deck too, as it turns out. But they also let you put those wherever you like.
Yeah, you are correct. I believe CFT Sock. Oh no, CFT Sock's last list did in fact have the two Omnaths. Previously, it was a Cavalier of Dawn, which
hell yeah.
I'm just gonna let that one disappear into the aether and not make anyone remember what it does.
It does a lot of things on the way in and on the way out as well. Only true Enchantes fans will know the full text on that one. So. On that happy note, I think we can get people out of here for the week. So you can find me on Twitter at Dom and Javier. You can find Ari at ARMLX. You can find the podcast on Twitter at @Dominaria_pod or on Patreon at patreon.com/Dominaria_judgment, where you can also find me before too long. So look for that in the show notes and on other platforms as well. You can find our columns every week on SEG and TCG/... almost said CFB player, TCG player /CFB, there we go, respectively. And you can find lots of Enchantes perverts and other beautiful species over in the Discord. So again, links to all of that in the show notes, link to various standard resources. There hasn't been a ton of just public standard content yet, but a refreshing number of people, you're posting deck lists, streaming and so on. So not going to say standard is back just yet, but it's not back either. We're gradually getting there. So hopefully you will be a part of that along with us. Hopefully this episode has given you a nudge in the right direction on that front. So we'll be back soon with something other than standard, but we'll be checking in here and there. But until then, take care, everyone.